This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, North Carolina's Attorney General comes out in support of the lawsuit against President Trump's immigration ban. A North Carolina House bill would penalize immigration sanctuary cities, but Charlotte says it isn't one. The North Carolina Senate defies a court order and tries to hold hearings on one of Roy Cooper's cabinet nominees, and Mayor Roberts goes on the offensive in her State of the City speech, even as a challenger enters the race. Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and more, and we're joined by WFAE's Tom Bullock. What a surprise. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Sean Flynn is managing editor of Time Warner Cable News.
Much more of a surprise.
No, not really. I knew you were coming. They warned me. Glenn Birkins is editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com.
Hi, Mike.
Welcome back. And Ann Doss Helms joins us from the Charlotte Observer.
Good morning.
You can reach us through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org and search for WFAE on Facebook, or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. Use the hashtag WFAE Roundup. Well, the courts handed down their decision last night on President Trump's immigration ban late yesterday afternoon, I guess it was, and they said essentially the ban will not go into force until a higher court takes a look at this. Prior to that decision, however, North Carolina's Attorney General Josh Stein offered his opinion. He called it a religious-based ban and therefore unconstitutional, and he was not alone among attorneys general. Who else came out against it?
Well, the key plaintiffs in this case are the state of Washington and the state of Minnesota.
Right.
And then you had, I believe, 16 states, including North Carolina, that had their attorneys general also sign on to the lawsuit. And when this came down last night, it was really interesting because officially what this is, it's a restraining order, basically. It's a stay. And this was a decision by three judges on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is out west, that upheld an earlier federal judge's ruling that this order has some significant issues to it. They did not rule on the legality of the order itself, but they did state that although both sides have good arguments and clear public interest on both sides, that there is irrevocable damage to the states that ensued if this went into place. So they ordered the stay to be held until at such time the constitutionality of the executive order banning the immigration from seven majority Muslim nations and refugees can be decided.
And the court obviously agreed with that argument, but why? Why? What kind of irreparable damage could there be to states?
Well, there's a couple of things here. And I took some notes, and I also read through the order this morning. First of all, the judges said basically the states can sue because of the fact that employees of the state system, the universities basically, can't do research, could potentially not be able to do research, could potentially not be able to travel. So they found that these states, in fact, had standing. But more interesting to me is a question about due process. And due process is something that most Americans realize the Constitution grants American citizens. Mm-hmm. But it also grants certain due process rights to non-citizens. Mm-hmm. Specifically, there is the question of people who have green cards. And when you are given a green card in the United States, you are granted all the same constitutional rights as a citizen. You are a legal permanent resident. But the court also strayed a little farther to say the fact that this order revoked visas that are issued by the U.S. government to people who are not green card holders, who are just people who are traveling, whether they be students or tourists or business people or the like, by revoking those visas without due process, it was a potential violation of the Constitution and the due process clause. And they also ordered there was no immediate need for this executive order, that they had time to go through it because of the fact, and this was really interesting to me, and the court is absolutely right in this case, without a doubt on this point, that the seven majority Muslim countries that are banned from – the residents are banned from traveling to the United States for a period of time, no one from these countries has committed a terrorist act in the United States.
Right.
None.
These attorneys general from these 16 states, and they include New York, California, Pennsylvania, Washington, I think Massachusetts, Hawaii, if that's H-A, Virginia.
It is. They did.
Thank you. Oregon, Connecticut, Vermont, Illinois, New Mexico, Iowa, Maine, Maryland, North Carolina, and Washington, D.C. wrote this. They said, as the chief legal officers for over 130 million Americans and foreign residents of our states, we condemn President Trump's unconstitutional, un-American, and unlawful executive order. First of all, how unusual is it for attorneys general to respond to things like this and to use that kind of language, condemn.
I think it is unusual. It is certainly not unprecedented. There were a number of lawsuits that attorneys general from predominantly Republican states filed against the Obama administration where they use some – and I don't have the language directly off the top of my head, but they have used that kind of language in the past. But what really is issue here, and it's a final point that the judges pointed to in keeping this stay on the travel ban, is intent. And I think that's what Josh Stein, actually our attorney general here in North Carolina, he brought up this point when it came to why he joined an amicus brief on this case. And that is that candidate Donald Trump made it clear that he wanted a Muslim ban, a complete and total Muslim ban. He recorded it. He put out statements. He tweeted it. It was a major plank in his campaign. Intent is, in the court's view, part of this case. So even though there are a myriad of other majority Muslim countries that were not included in this ban, that intent may be unconstitutional because we have a clause in our government, in the Constitution, that bars religious tests. It's part of the founding tenets of the United States, and that is something that the court pointed out.
So once again, with a Democratic Attorney General, Josh Stein, and a Republican legislature, we have a repeat of the tensions between the Attorney General's office and the legislature. What reaction has Joel Stein gotten from his participation in these with these other attorneys general against this order? Anything from the legislature about his objections to it?
I think the state legislature is battling him over a number of other issues, not necessarily that issue specifically.
Okay. I think Dallas Woodhouse, though, the executive director of the North Carolina Republican Party,
and Robin Hayes
both came out and said that he has no business doing this, that, in fact, immigration policy is a core tenet of the president's authority.
And I don't think anyone is surprised that he would join 15 other Democratic attorneys general in opposing this. I think Tom is absolutely right. We have seen this before. Even on issues of immigration, when Republican governors took President Obama to court to basically stop his executive order on immigration.
I also think from the get-go, once the travel ban was enacted that Friday, I definitely think there was some coordination among several states to identify the best path of resistance. Having Washington file it, and then going through the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, we pretty much already knew where this was going to come down because the Ninth Circuit, being a former recovering California reporter, it definitely leans more towards that direction. I'm not saying that the Fourth Circuit or any of the other wouldn't have sided the same way, but they definitely took the path of least resistance.
But I will say this. I'm sorry, Mike, but I will say this. And Sean's right. The Ninth Circuit has a reputation of being a more liberal circuit. But this was a unanimous ruling by a three-judge panel, which included a Republican appointee.
Absolutely.
Well, one of you just said that the immigration is the purview of the president and the federal government. However, County Commissioner Bill James wants the U.S. Justice Department to look into Charlotte to see if we're doing enough to comply with the order, which has been stayed right now. But he questioned CMPD's policy of not asking people with whom they come into contact about their immigration status. And the reason for that is that federal funds, he says, could be in jeopardy if we are not asking those questions. And James is joined by three other Republicans who want to make sure that we're in compliance, and also a city council member, Ed Driggs, who's a fourth Republican, who agrees that we should ask the Justice Department for their opinion. What has the city attorney said about that?
The city attorney says that Charlotte's fine, that we have not proclaimed this a sanctuary city, that if there were to be any action on this, it would be against a city like San Francisco that is openly defiant. You know, it sort of comes down to, do we pick this fight? And Bill James is trying to say we should go to them and we should ask.
New York City is openly defiant,
right,
in this area. And these are major cities around the country that are defiant, and it is the cities that bring in all the tax dollars in the country. So is this another example of the urban-rural divide?
Not for the federal government. I mean, the federal government is getting you can talk about higher salaries in cities, but this is actually – there's two things at play here. First of all, just to be clear, the executive order banning travel is not part of the sanctuary cities thing. That is actually a threat that President Trump has made that he has not yet acted on. But yeah, I think opinions about sanctuary cities, to your point, Mike, is absolutely part of the urban-rural divide, part of the Democratic-Republican divide, part of what is becoming an incredibly politically polarized nation. Mm-hmm. The idea goes back of sanctuary cities goes back to the 1980s. I mean, it originates with religious movements who felt the need to let refugees from Central American civil wars come to the United States to find sanctuary, to find safety, hence sanctuary city. We here in Charlotte and in Mecklenburg are in an interesting spot because, first of all, there is a law on the books from North Carolina that bars any city from being a sanctuary city that says that you cannot stop your police force from asking questions.
And that is precisely what the mayor said when I asked her if, point blank, is Charlotte a sanctuary city? She was on this program a few days ago, and here's what she said.
Charlotte has never described itself as a sanctuary city. And we have not said that we're going to ignore deportation orders. In fact, the state passed a law prohibiting sanctuary cities in North Carolina, and we are complying with state and federal law. So we want to be a welcoming city within state and federal law.
But the police department asserts that it's not their job to ask a person that they're stopping for a traffic violation or whatever it may be, to whether they have a green card or whether they are here legally. But the sheriff's office, which runs the jail in the county, partners with the federal government through the 287G program to detain people in the country illegally, who are in the country illegally. And because we participated in Mecklenburg County in that program, the San Francisco-based Immigrant Legal Resource Center, which is an advocacy group, mm-hmm. has placed Mecklenburg County in the most restrictive category toward undocumented immigrants, among them in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Should that not put all these concerns about sanctuary city to bed?
I think it really boils down on just your general feeling on exactly what should happen. I mean, to be clear, and that this is why it's a complicated case here in Charlotte and in Mecklenburg. The state law that Mayor Roberts spoke about does not mandate that police ask. It just says they cannot be stopped from asking someone's immigration status. So
language to that effect was actually removed from CMPD directives.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely
right. It's important to note, too, that this is not just about sort of philosophy of being welcoming to immigrants. This mm-hmm. is viewed in Charlotte Mecklenburg Police Department as a step toward effective law enforcement, mm-hmm. that if you are seen as an enforcement arm as volunteering to work with ICE and your first thing is – are you documented? Right. You know, can we deport you? Then you will see the immigrant communities withdraw from reporting crimes and be much more easy targets for crime.
And the argument has been made that if you want people who see something to say something,
right.
they're not going to say something if they think they're going to be arrested and deported.
Right.
Exactly.
Meanwhile, to ice the cake, Republican state legislatures are making another effort to cut off state funding for sanctuary cities that refuse to enforce federal immigration policies. Are there any sanctuary cities in North Carolina?
By law, no.
No.
But, I mean, are there any acting as sanctuary cities, whether the law is there or not?
I think that comes down, again, to interpretation. I'm not trying to dodge this. It really does. Because you have, again, police forces like CMPD that will not ask because they're not mandated to ask by law, but they if they pull somebody over for a traffic stop or if they're investigating something, as Chief Putney said just this week, you know, we're only looking for victims of crimes, perpetrators of crimes, and witnesses. We don't care what your status is.
So given that stance and our close relationship with Raleigh, is that being seen as anti-cooperation?
Quickly? I don't know.
It depends on who's right. It depends on who's looking.
But let's take a break and we'll think about it. And we'll come back on the other side with talk about Roy Cooper and his legislature and his relationship there. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Donald Hack Diamonds, hosting a Philip Gavriel trunk show in celebration of Valentine's Day. Today, 10 a.m. till 6 p.m. and tomorrow, 10 a.m. till 4, featuring chocolate and wine pairings. Details at donaldhack.com. And Blumenthal Performing Arts presenting Fiesta Flamenca, a performance of flamenco, a multicultural art form demonstrating its power to build bridges between cultures, February 16th through 18th at the Booth Playhouse. Tickets available at 704-372-1000. It's been a year since the Charlotte City Council voted on a non-discrimination ordinance that turned into the opening salvo in the fight over LGBT protections in the state and moved the transgender community front and center. But transgender parents have been dealing with this for far longer, and we'll meet and hear from three parents of transgender kids to share their children's journey and their own as they navigated these uncharted waters Monday on this program at 9.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Jeff Sessions, Betty DeVos confirmed, Elizabeth Warren silenced, Trump's travel ban, and the Ninth Circuit Court. Our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
The news roundup continues with On Point at 10 o'clock following Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with our roundtable of reporters on the local news roundup. Ann Doss Helms is here from the Charlotte Observer. Sean Flynn from Time Warner Cable News. Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com. And Tom Bullock from WFAE News. The court system. I hope they've been on the treadmill warming up because they are really getting the workout these days, federally and statewide. With the election of Roy Cooper as governor, Republicans in the legislature decided that all of Roy Cooper's cabinet nominees needed to have hearings in the state Senate. But Cooper disagreed, and late Tuesday night, I believe it was, the evening before the first hearing, a three-judge panel issued a temporary order to halt the proceedings. There's a lot of this going on. Legislators point to a clause in the state constitution that seems pretty clear on this. It reads, "The governor shall nominate, and by and with the advice and consent of a majority of the senators, appoint all officers whose appointments are not otherwise provided for." It's been there for a long time, but seldom used, but it seems pretty clear.
I mean, that's certainly what Republican lawmakers feel, and it actually led to one of the more interesting exchanges at the trial. This is a temporary restraining order. There'll be another case on Friday about this. There'll be another case in March about this. So this is by no means a final
Friday
word.
Being today. They're arguing it today. Yes.
But there was this interesting exchange between the panel of Superior Court judges and lawyers for House Speaker Tim Moore and Senate Pro Tem Phil Berger, and you know, obviously they see this, and they said as much in a press release after the decision came out. They see this as judicial overreach, and they actually argued that if the judges put a stay on this, a restraining order on this, that it would be judicial overreach. And the lawyers for Republican leaders said one of the judges said to the lawyers of the Republican leaders, "So would you advise your clients to ignore this order?" And the lawyer said, "No, I always advise my clients to follow a court order." But the Senate sure didn't. They absolutely went ahead with the confirmation hearing of Larry Hall at 11 a.m. on Wednesday as scheduled. But clearly their nerves were crunchy, to say the least, about it, because when the hearing was gaveled into session, there was this nice name placard that said Larry Hall and an empty seat and no Larry Hall. He is the nominee that Cooper had for Military and Veterans Affairs. And he didn't show up to the hearing. He followed the court order. I don't want to make it sound like he was just being inconsiderate, but he just didn't show up.
And if he had showed up, you wonder what would have happened. Would they have been in contempt of that court order? I mean, this whole challenging of the legislative saying we choose not to respect the judicial branch is really an interesting thing that's playing out here.
And in Washington, we had the example of, I think, all of the Democrats failing to show up for certain hearings on Capitol Hill for certain nominees. This is clearly a power struggle between left and right, Democrat and Republican, et cetera. How long can this go on? This seems to be getting worse, not better. And how can you run a government that is structured the way ours is if neither side will cooperate with the other, and the courts have to get involved, and they don't want to even cooperate, they don't even want to cooperate with the courts?
Well, there is one.
I think,
I'm sorry, Glenn.
To answer that question, I think we're just seeing the beginning of it, frankly.
Yes.
As this country becomes, and I've said this on this show before, as this country becomes more diverse, it's becoming more liberal. And this is what you're seeing. You're really seeing a battle for control of state government, the federal government, between the liberal left and the conservative right. And as this country becomes more liberal, that shrinking conservative part has to devise new ways to stay in power. Thus, we're seeing gerrymandered districts. Thus, we're seeing isolated victories through the Electoral College, even though they're losing popular votes. So I think you're just starting to see this battle, whether it's over voter ID or whatever. I think we're going to see measures that we never dreamed we would see. And increasingly, they're going to be settled by the courts.
And the problem for me, the disturbing trend that I see both nationally and here in the state, is an absolute outright disdain for what has always been created and intended to be an equal branch of government.
Yes.
One direct line that, yes, exactly. One direct line that you can see, whether it's President Donald Trump tweeting, "I'll see you in court," to a bunch of justices, which, I, as I was saying to Ann earlier, that actually is probably rather convenient for them since that's exactly where they work. And you're also seeing from, you know, Republican lawmaker, Republican leaders in Raleigh, is this, let's just attack them as being the judges, the justices making these decisions as just being nothing but liberal wannabe politicians. Mm-hmm. And just like with the Ninth Circuit in the Superior Court panel that heard this stay, one of the members was appointed by a Republican. And the bigger question, though, is if you constantly sow these seeds of doubt in an equal branch of government, you are really setting up a very, I'll say, troubling situation if you start ending trust, yes, public
and
trust.
And you see this too with the Fourth Estate. The news media has been dubbed the Fourth Estate, and there's that same type of, you know, they're all dishonest, they're the opposition party, disregard them, you know, disregard. And that's what sort of has forced us to get along has been the system of checks and balances. Well, and the idea that you can't just have one person in power or one party in power or one group making all the rules.
And I think one of the things that's most disturbing to me personally is for years we've had experienced this on the federal level that there's been such bipartisanship, but it seems like it's really trickled down to the local level, that the infighting is getting worse and worse. I mean, I remember a decade ago covering the city council, and you had its major opponents like John Tabor and Harold Cogdale sitting there debating a Charlotte City Council issue and then fighting tooth and nail over this issue. As soon as it was decided, they're sitting there slapping each other on the back and joking about it. I don't see that anymore. I don't see that camaraderie and the ability to work together and actually try to compromise.
Well, that's another show. Why the stakes are so high is another show. But in this case with Roy Cooper taking issue with the Senate wanting to hold hearings on all of his nominees, with the wording in the Constitution, the way it is, which I just read, is the court likely ultimately to decide in the Senate's favor?
I don't think we know on this. I mean, I'll be honest with you. I read through the temporary restraining order looking for a justification, looking for an explanation, because the justices said that they believed that Governor Roy Cooper had a very good chance of winning on the merits. But this clause is in Article 3 of our state constitution. I don't know.
You wonder if this is almost what you cited with the federal situation, that they're looking at the broader context, that there have been a lot of moves that just seem to be extemporaneously about Republicans taking power away from any Democrats that are left. So they're maybe looking at that as much as the actual letter of the law.
So the case is scheduled to be argued in front of the court today. And as I understand it, this is merely to consider issuing a longer restraining order.
Correct.
They would come back again in March to talk about the legality of the confirmation hearings. Why? Why don't they just go ahead and decide that now? And in the interim, what happens to the cabinet? Do the nominees get put into limbo, or do they just take office and do what they do?
The latter. It's quite clearly spelled out, actually, in the temporary restraining order, that they should be allowed to run their departments freely. So they take office.
So why not make the decision today? Why not? Why wait till March?
Well, you know, the legal process, love it or hate it, is a very established process. You need time for arguments. You need time to build briefs. Moving it actually to March, some would see as already an expedited process.
Okay. Well, the legislature is clearly back at work, even if people aren't showing up for the hearings. And one of the first things they did was to introduce House Bill 23 as a fix for the unintended consequences of a previous bill to reduce class sizes in the primary grades. Ann, you're the education expert here. Where is that bill now, and why do some see this as critical, and how likely is it to pass?
Well, I'm not the Raleigh expert, so I'm not sure exactly where it is in the process. It does seem to be moving along, and I think that it probably is likely to pass.
Well, back up and talk about the unintended consequence. What bill was it that has caused the potential cancellation of things like PE and art classes because to achieve the budgetary constraints of reducing class size, you have to eliminate that because there are not enough teachers?
This was a bill that said something that sounds great on the surface, because those early grades are so important and because so many people agree that a smaller class size lets a teacher focus more on the individual kids, we're going to mandate a certain size, around 19 students for those grade levels. And the intended or unintended consequence was that requires more teachers and also more physical classrooms. And the state did not provide money to hire those more teachers. So it became, you know, we either make huge classes in other grades or we pull out things like art and physical education. And those teachers, you know, we have to reallocate the positions so that we can have more teachers in the lower grades.
And the folks that introduced House Bill 23 to fix this acknowledged that this was an unintended consequence of a previous piece of legislation. So, Tom, since you've been following this from the legislative point of view, where is it now, that bill, and how critical is it, and is it likely to pass?
It has pretty broad support. I mean, honestly, to Ann's point, if you are trying to shrink class sizes but you accidentally end music programs and art programs and PE programs because you forgot to add money into it, Republicans and Democrats can agree something needs to be done. But to answer your direct question, it went through committees this week. It, I believe, is going to be on the House floor as early as Tuesday.
And what's interesting about this one is it's one of just around 100 bills that have been introduced so far in this legislation. This same time 2 years ago, there was about 1,000 bills.
Wow.
So it just goes to show you that this legislature is acting much more deliberate.
Okay. And we've described this as an unintended consequence, but it shouldn't have been an unforeseen consequence. I mean, I think the legislators are all smart enough to know that if you mandate something that requires more teachers – that costs money, and I don't know where they thought that money was going to come from.
Legislators are also working on bills to reduce the number of free license plates being issued and another to reduce the size of the University of North Carolina Board of Governors from 32 to 24. And we had Margaret Spellings, the UNC system president, on the program on Monday. Here's what she said about reducing the size of the Board of Governors.
Well, as we look around the country at governance systems, we're really an outlier among states. You know, average governing boards are about, you know, a dozen people. You know, they range from nine to into the teens. It's always, obviously, no matter what the number is, about the quality of people who are on the board. So 32, you know, well-intended, very educated, fully committed people is always going to be better than nine, you know, folks who have a particular agenda or a particular pet project. But I do think, you know, if we had to start with a blank sheet of paper, particularly in a time when we're so interconnected, that, you know, fewer probably makes sense.
Mm-hmm. She also went on to say that the university is essentially top-heavy from its board of governors through its administrative staff, and culling the herd would bring efficiencies and cost savings all around. But when it comes to the Board of Governors, some Democrats see this as potentially lessening diversity on the board. What are you hearing about why this is being suggested? What are the motivations behind this? Anybody know?
Go ahead, Sean.
Well, that's a good one. I'm trying to figure out what the motivation, after talking with several people, what the motivation necessarily would be. Part of it is cost cutting. I believe there is some cost savings that have it. And, you know, I'm not trying to get in the mind of Republican lawmakers and what they're trying to figure out.
Well, there's some Democratic lawmakers who see this as a way to limit diversity on the board.
Right. Well, if you're going to limit, take eight people off the board, yeah, you're going to limit diversity.
It doesn't have to eliminate
that's
diversity.
And certainly for all of us who have covered governing bodies with, you know, nine people or whatever, it is really hard to imagine 32 people around a table effectively making policy.
Yeah, but, you know, the key thing here is this bill so far has had broad bipartisan support. There are only four Democrats that have voted against it, no Republicans. And this is in the North Carolina House. But Floyd McKissick, who epic guy, to say the least, a civil rights icon, just a really interesting man, is the one who actually brought up the concerns that this could limit diversity. And he tried to add an amendment that would somehow designate language that would say that diversity would be on the board, not a quota per se, but something that would ensure that it's not just a bunch of, you know, I believe what he said in committee meeting is it's not all white or it's not all male or it's not all female. Whatever it is, we make sure that there's language to make sure that the minority voices are there. And the amendment failed. And basically the response that McKissick was given was, this is something we can do when the nominating process for these board positions is brought up. But inherently, with fewer spots, you have fewer opportunities. Mm. So I don't think that was the motivation. But, you know, people forget, at least some people forget, the UNC system includes historically black colleges and universities. Right. It's important that their voice is heard.
And it includes one that was created to be a Native American system.
Absolutely.
Have pointed out that there's no representation there.
Absolutely. Okay.
There's also a bill in front of the legislature that would make it illegal to pet while driving. Illegal to drive.
It's a whole other bill, Mike.
We're all now imagining that.
It would be illegal to drive with a pet on your lap. Same thing. Have we had a lot of accidents in North Carolina by drivers with pets in their lap? What's provoking this bill? What's the need here?
Well, the story did say that a quick internet search found several instances
of
serious wrecks caused while somebody had, you know, I've driven with my dogs in the car, and they're small, and, you know, it's distracting if they start moving around. I don't know. I don't drive with one in my lap, and the one quote said something about that it was dangerous to the pets because they could jump out. I think they could jump out from any window. It seems like maybe one of those things that is a real issue but maybe doesn't need a law to address. Common sense, maybe?
I remember one time I was transporting a cat in my car, and I just let the cat roam around. All of a sudden, in the passenger seat, the cat's rolling down the window.
Ah.
I'm going 65 miles per hour down the highway, and I'm like, hey, you don't want to do that.
So you're the reason.
I'm the reason.
I've actually seen a number of drivers in Charlotte driving around with dogs.
Yeah,
in their
me
laps.
Too.
I don't know how much they're having accidents, but it's not unusual.
I saw somebody watching a movie the other day driving.
Really? Yesterday, the Raleigh News and Observer reported that a bipartisan group of North Carolina state legislators want to pay themselves an extra $60 a day while in session beginning in 2019. So in fairness, this would be after the next elections. It would not necessarily affect everybody who's in favor of this because they might be voted out. The bill also calls for doubling mileage expenses, something that hasn't been addressed in 20 years, a long time. And although this extra $60 a day would cost the state millions of dollars, their annual salary is not what many people think it is. A lot of people, I'm told, think it's $100,000. No, it's $13,951. That, too, has not increased in decades. Is this likely to pass?
I don't know. That's interesting in that it's always difficult to vote for raising salaries.
It wouldn't
for
be for body. Them. It would
right.
be for
and
future
there is that,
legislators.
Yeah. But, I mean, there will be people who will be saying, look at these guys. They've held all these special sessions. You know, they keep coming back and paying themselves per diem, and now they want, even in the future, more for that. But there is also an argument to be made that if the pay is very low, then the only way that you can do that is if you are basically independently wealthy. That
right.
you, and it is a time-consuming job. It's not 24/7, but it's...
When you put on these per diems and you put on overtime, and I think the highest pay is something like $58,000, and that may go to the Speaker of the House or the President of the Senate. I'm not sure which. But when you think about the fact that most of these people all have jobs outside of this...
All of them.
...and have to travel... That doesn't seem unreasonable.
And they all have to have jobs that allow them to take 6 months off at a time to head up to Raleigh.
I think if it reaches a vote, it will pass because of some of the reasons you mentioned. It's been a long time since the pay was increased. But what's interesting to me is that it's one of the few things that actually has bipartisan support.
More money for us.
I wonder why. Glenn
we
Birkins,
found unity.
Glenn Birkins, editor-publisher of QCityMetro.com, and Doss Helms from The Observer, Sean Flynn from Time Warner Cable News, and Tom Bullock from WFAE News. And we'll continue when we come back on Charlotte Talks. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Corkscrew Wine Shop and Bar. New location now open at The View in downtown Charlotte near BB&T Ballpark. Full portfolio of wine and beer from all over the world, plus live music. Details at thescrewcrew.com. And Urgent Vet Pet Clinic, providing veterinary urgent care 365 days a year for Charlotte pet owners. Locations now open in Fort Mill and Belmont. Your pet can't wait to feel better. More info at urgentvet.com. A federal appeals court keeps a block on President Trump's travel ban in place. Jeff Sessions sworn in as the Attorney General, and Betsy DeVos begins work as Education Secretary, while Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren is silenced on the Senate floor. Just some of the stories they'll be talking about as we expand this into the national roundup on Point with Tom Ashbrook in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. Stay with us.
The story of President Trump's first 100 days is unfolding not just in Washington, but all across America.
These sorts of things that are happening right now, we have to stand up. And if we don't stand up, then it normalizes.
He's got the right idea. We've got to put our country first, not just on the pro-life issue, but with everything. We've got to get jobs back into the
country. Count on NPR News to follow the way decisions in Washington affect your hometown. Listen every day.
News you can trust from 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and it's the local news roundup with Tom Bullock, Sean Flynn, Glenn Birkins, and Doss Helms on our roundtable today. I think we need to develop some sort of a musical sounder when we talk about this next topic, because it's becoming a regular feature. HB2. The clock is ticking on HB2, at least on the NCAA, because they are going to consider in the next...
Starting now.
Yeah. What happens for the next 6 years with regard to games being played in North Carolina? Why can't they do this year by year?
Because they don't. They don't have to. I mean, realistically, it might help people to think about this like the Olympics, but you don't have to build new venues. Cities, universities, colleges bid for the right to hold these games. It's free advertising for the schools. It's money coming in from the people who come to watch it. And this is true from the biggest ticket there is in NCAA, I would argue, which is the men's basketball tournament. And I'm a football fan, but believe me, if you look at overall ticket sales, that's the big one. All the way down to, swim championships that most people, have never had a chance to go to. These bid processes take time, and what's going on right now is they're considering them, the bids that have been put in. And North Carolina currently has 133 bids for these kinds of things on the table.
And Greensboro gets a lot of these.
Yeah, Greensboro. Charlotte gets them.
Yeah.
Raleigh, they're carry all over the place. But because of the stance that the NCAA has on House Bill 2, they have found it to be discriminatory. They've called for it to be changed, mm-hmm. if not outright repealed. Right. They have pulled games already, as has the ACC and a number of other sports leagues. There is a chance that the state of North Carolina could be locked out of hosting any of these for the next 6 years.
This is another potential monetary loss. I read somewhere that it's $250 million, and I wasn't clear on whether that's per year or over the course of 6 years, $250 million. How much longer can legislators ignore the losses of millions of dollars in revenue, not only to the state but to small-time people who are the vendors at these venues, and refused to repeal this when they got so close to a repeal just months ago?
I think they can ignore it for quite a while, actually. I've said this before as well, that all of those cities you named are fairly major cities in the states, and those tend to be, and I hate to keep bringing this back to politics, but yes, they tend to be Democratic.
If this law is not repealed and the games are pulled for 6 years, will there be any incentive left to provoke any discussions on a repeal? Or will that's it? We've lost all these games, and what else can they threaten us with, so let's just leave it in place?
Well, there's still business recruiting.
Right.
And I think that you still have a pretty big push from a lot of corporations saying the kind of place where we want to locate or expand are the kinds of places that are friendly to all of our employees, including the LGBT ones.
But I will say this, and I agree with what both Ann and Glenn have just said, but this is North Carolina, and I've said this on the show before too, this is North Carolina's first real experience with divided government, right? Democratic governor, Republican supermajorities at the General Assembly. And there really is a kind of a window of repealing HB2 for this simple reason. If it goes on too long and the losses, whether it's jobs or potential income or whatever, continue, it starts to become easier and easier for the Republicans to start blaming the governor, the Republicans blaming the Democrat for not being able to lure the jobs or not being able to do this. It's equally easy for the governor to continue to blame the legislature for not just outright repealing House Bill 2. It's easy for both sides to get into this camp, to their camps, and that trench in between them to grow. So, depending on where you sit on House Bill 2, and there are some people who truly, truly in their hearts believe it is about public safety, and there are others who believe truly, truly it is simply about discriminating for the right to discriminate. And the more we pull back into these camps, the less likely it is that anything happens anytime soon to do what it seems both Democrats and Republicans in the legislature do want to do at some point, which is stop HB2 from being on the books.
And I love what's going on now is that everyone, you know, Democrats are calling for full repeal of HB2 and Senator Berger saying, I voted for repeal of HB2. Yeah. And so now the issues become so muddled, I don't think a lot of the average Joe even understands what's going on anymore other than the fact that they're not going to be able to watch the ACC championship games here in Charlotte.
Glenn. Going back to your question, Mike, what will it take for Republicans to finally get serious about repealing it? I think it will take some demonstrable loss of some large economic development project in a rural part of the state. I think until
this are there becomes, any of those?
Well,
is that part of the problem?
Sure, I'll bring up the great white whale of economic development that North Carolina has been chasing forever: car plant.
Yes.
If there was a manufacturer who wanted to set up an automotive, you know, manufacturing center in North Carolina, and it would likely be in rural North Carolina. Who then suddenly told the state legislature not going to do it because of HB2.
That would change.
I think that would turn heads.
But are they even looking at us, knowing that HB2 is in place? If some car manufacturer wanted to is looking for a place, would they even consider it? Would they even let us know that they're considering it?
And that's a good point about that window disappearing, that, you know, when this first happened, you had people that were actively, you know, involved in the recruitment process who literally said, we walked away because of this. And what you're saying is probably true, that if you're eliminating states that have this kind of law, you're never putting North Carolina on your list anymore.
Legislative Democrats unveiled a bill to repeal HB2 while also adding statewide non-discrimination protections for a variety of groups. Is this dead in the water before it even leaves?
Yes.
Yep.
Hope springs eternal.
Well, I will say this. There are actually two bills, and I'm only going to bring up the reason that it's – let's just say it's a major uphill climb for either of these bills is because it would actually make Charlotte's ordinance basically statewide. So it's not just repealing HB2. It's the opposite of HB2. But I do want to bring up the second bill, which was sponsored by Representative Cecil Brockman of High Point. And he included – the two bills are almost identical, except his bill, Brockman's bill, has this added section that dramatically increases any sexual crimes that are committed in a bathroom or changing facility. And I'm talking between 3 and 7 years of additional sentencing if it's taking place in those kinds of facilities. And he, at least I thought, it was an interesting argument. He's like, look, I put this on there because I hope that Republicans will see it as a negotiating point, as trying to find compromise. Yeah. Because again, right now, you're not seeing a whole lot. So I is it dead in the water? Yeah, probably. But at least he's trying to find a common ground.
And that is interesting because that is still the talking point. That is, this is about keeping those men in dresses who are going to hang out in, you know, in the women's changing rooms that HB2 is protecting us from them.
Okay, well, let's move on because we could talk about this again next week. in an historic move, Vice President Mike Pence cast the deciding vote on Betsy DeVos to be the Secretary of Education. Both of North Carolina's senators, Richard Burr and Tom Tillis, voted yes on her appointment. But both of Tom Tillis and Richard Burr's offices say they received tons of calls urging them to vote against her. So are we to assume that they got more calls in support?
No. We're just to assume, I think, that they felt like she was the right person for the job, or if you're more cynical, that she made some really nice donations to their campaigns.
Well, she did make about $43,000 or $34,000 or something like that.
$43,000 to Senator Burr and okay. $72,000 to Senator Tillis.
Why such an odd number? Why not like $75,000 and $50,000?
I'm sure I'm not positive, but I have a feeling it was probably a big chunk of money that was then divvied out to lots of different
senators. And there are campaign finance limits and a myriad of reasons. It's not just random.
All right.
I think we can also assume that they may have concluded that the people who were calling them were people who probably did not vote for them anyway and would not vote for them in the future.
Okay.
Also possibly a lot of out-of-state calls.
And there was some opposition to her nomination and appointment based on a lot of things, including her performance in the hearings, her lack of experience with public schools, her ties to charter schools. What have you heard, Ann, from people within CMS, maybe some deep background conversations about how people in education, professionals, regard her?
I think she is not at all highly regarded within the professional, especially the traditional public school establishment. And that's exactly why some people love her, because they say, you know, we don't want this entrenched mindset, that we want somebody who's coming at this from a different angle. I think school choice, the politics of this tend to be very partisan, but in real life, school choice is not neatly divided. We've mentioned that here before. There are Democrats who strongly support charter schools and even vouchers. There are low-income and minority people who support these things. So it's kind of interesting. We're seeing choice play out right now very actively as families are trying to decide what they want to do with their children for the next year. And charters are very popular, and vouchers are growing here. There are also people who think that's really destructive to public education.
One of the fears is that she will give up too much control to local districts and states on enforcing non-discrimination and civil rights protections in schools. If that were, in fact, to happen, how would that impact CMS? Would there be any change, really?
Well, the whole question of how they're going to treat LGBT students that kind of came up during the summer when Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools, when things were up in court, and they said, well, based on Title IX and some things like this, here's how we're going to handle these issues. So, there could be some constraints on things like who could use which changing rooms, how they would deal with a transgender student.
Right.
That could play out here.
Meanwhile, there's a proposal to create a town-sponsored charter school campus in Matthews. This is that business park-style campus idea that I saw floated in the paper, the same thing?
Yeah, right? This is... And at this point, it is very preliminary. It's basically a plan drawn up by the chair of the mayoral education task force in Matthews, which was created because they're so concerned about what Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools might do with boundaries, that they might disperse what they view as their community schools there in Matthews. So the plan is that the town, either by itself or in partnership with some type of developer, would pick a plot of land, perhaps develop the buildings, have a campus where charter schools could come in, multiple charter schools offering different types of themes, and there would be potentially a joint playground and a joint cafeteria and maybe even a coffee house and an after-school tutoring service. And charter schools, as I think people know, are public schools, tuition-free, optional. So what they're saying is people who want could still go to Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools. But we would have our little community here of charter schools.
And it's a way for a lot of these towns to so-called break off from Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools without actually having to go through the hassle of breaking off and creating their own school district if you create these charter schools. Because I will tell you that the CMS assignment plan is creating – so far, there's officially no official boundaries that have been drawn up. But I know a lot of people who already I can't say it any other way, but freaking out about what's about to happen.
There were other areas of Mecklenburg County that have talked about this many times in the past, splitting away from CMS. Is it easier to do it now that they've raised the cap on charter schools? Because they don't have to split and start, as Sean just said, they don't have to start their own system anymore. They could just start charter schools.
Well, it's not clear that towns can start charter schools. And this plan actually would require – first of all, it would have to be endorsed by – the Matthews Town Council, and then pushed to the legislature. And they are asking for some things that are not currently available. Like right now, a charter school has to accept whoever applies and do it by lottery. They say if we contribute, some facilities, then we want Matthews residents to get first choice. This would open up, if it were to happen, and that's still a big if, I think you would see a large number of developments that would like to do the same thing. If you are creating a big development, the most attractive thing you can have other than a great location and houses. Yeah, if you can say, look, we will pay or we will provide land and here is this school that will just be for our residents and you won't have to deal with those outsiders and, we can decide what people are reading into outsiders.
Watch out, River District.
Yeah,
Mayor Roberts gave her State of the City address this week, described the city as being on the offensive, or it was described as her saying the city was on the offensive. What does that mean?
She came out against, never said Donald Trump's name directly, but that Charlotte was going to stick to its values regardless of what leadership in Washington was pushing for. She pushed back against good old House Bill 2 by saying, the legislature should just leave Charlotte alone because we're the biggest economic engine here. They just need to get out of the way.
I asked her about that because I said, aren't you rubbing salt in the wound? And she said, no, let Charlotte be Charlotte.
Yeah, and I don't think she's adding anything that – I don't think she's making the relationship any worse by saying that.
I think the wound's already filled with salt.
Yes. That's perfect.
And evidently on the local level that is true too, because the mayor's race is underway, at least for the primary, and the primary I think is in May. And
I think it's September.
Okay, fine.
September, I believe.
Whenever. I'll see you
coming
in September.
Up.
I'll see you in September. Roberts is running for re-election, and this week, City Councilman Vi Lyles, who happens to be the mayor pro tem, and fellow Democrat announced that she, too, is running. What are the differences between them? Big differences? Style differences?
It's more style and the way they handle each other, you know, handle different issues and things like that. One of the things I found fascinating is within an hour of Vi Lyles making that announcement, Mayor Roberts' campaign sent out an email saying, "All right, we have a Democratic primary opponent. We need money. We need it now."
Right.
That's exactly right.
She's talking, Vi Lyles is talking about uniting the city and allowing those who want to work to work. What does that mean?
Unclear at this point. I think obviously she's trying to address, if I can speculate here a little bit, trying to address the city's lack of economic mobility, obviously working on economic development. I think the bigger issue here, which was left unsaid, is why she doesn't think Mayor Roberts is capable of doing what she thinks she's capable of doing. And it's interesting, though. I mean, this is pretty early on for a Democrat to actually jump into the race. And we don't have
what's
a Republican
going to be interesting,
yet.
Actually, is to see what other Democrats might
agreed.
Enter.
Right, and because Jill Ford also yes. has an exploratory committee.
And this week, U.S. News & World Report has a new list of the 100 best places to live in the country, and we are not number one. That goes to Austin, Texas. We are not number seven. That goes to Raleigh. Charlotte is number 14. Has there been wailing and gnashing of teeth over this? I guess not. The magazine says many
no,
people,
but your desk will never recover.
Never recover. Many people, the magazine says, many people who call the Raleigh and Durham metro areas home are young, friendly, diverse, educated. They enjoy dining out in local restaurants, many of which have earned a national accolade. We, on,
oh,
the, other hand,
Charlotte
we on the other hand, were described as a standalone destination area now, no longer living in the shadow of Atlanta or Charleston. South Carolina. We beat Madison, Wisconsin, Minneapolis, St. Paul, San Francisco, and Houston. So there is some good news here. But clearly, these people have never set foot in Raleigh. Thank you all for the hour.